Wonderful, it's marvelous, she should care for me. Soft lies, it's paradise, it's what I love to see.
Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is Janine Basinger. She is the founder of the Department of Film Studies at Wesleyan University and the curator of the cinema archives there. We're talking about her latest book. It's a doozy. The Movie Musical. Janine, it's such a pleasure to be talking to you again.
Thank you so much. I look forward to our conversation.
I have to say, this is your best book yet.
Oh, thank you so much.
This book has so many pleasures. So much to say. There's a lot of analysis that's interesting and fun, and we cannot hope to do it justice in a mere 30 minutes. I'm saying that for the benefit of the audience. This is a book you have to read. But I also have to ask you, this is a book that seems to be the result of a lifetime's work.
Absolutely. I mean, starting when I was 3 years old, it is a labor of love, this book. I mean, for me, because like so many people in my age category, which is basically old, I grew up on musicals. I mean, that's right. I really grew up on them, and I always loved them. And so it was fun for me to do this. It was rewarding in every way, but it took a lot of energy and effort, and it took a lot of time also. I did go back and make sure I looked at every movie again and kept it fresh for myself, but it was fun to do.
The incredible thing about it is not only does it trace the entire history of the genre from then till now, and I mean literally to now, which was amazing, but it's also interestingly opinionated in different sections, and you back it up with ideas to back up your opinion. For instance, Baby Driver. I never thought I would see that in this book. I've watched the movie several times, and it's not until after I read your analysis of it, I went, oh, that's why it works for me.
Yeah, it's great. First of all, I love that movie, Baby Driver. I thought it was phenomenal. I like the director's work in general. I was writing this book and deeply in it when I went out to the theaters to see Baby Driver. And it was like weird for me. It was like, wait, this car and this driver are dancing. These are musical numbers. And the way they're cut to music and the way the car twirls around and speeds forward and moves back and the whole thing was just so clearly a dance number that I thought, I just have to include this. And it's interesting because a lot of people love, good fans of movies, love this movie, Baby Driver. They get it right away that this is a real movie, folks. Why don't we give the awards to movies like this? Because this is a movie. And a lot of people have commented on that to me, that they really appreciated that I included it and, you know, that it was great to think of it as a musical.
Well, this is what I'm talking about in this book, is that when I read a book that changes my ideas, my concepts about something, in this case, the film Baby Driver, I consider that a tremendous, worthwhile book. I mean, I would never have thought of that as a musical. And this brings us to the question, and you deal with this in the first chapter. How do we define a musical? Because as you make it very clear, a film is not a musical just because somebody gets up and sings a song.
Yeah, it's one of those strangely mysterious things that seems to be so obvious that when you examine it, turns out not to be obvious at all. The case I really like to think about, and that really first got me thinking about this, is Gilda. Mm-hmm. Gilda is not a musical. But Rita Hayworth, a musical star, does two numbers in it, one of which, Put the Blame on Mame, defines the whole movie and is the thing that everybody remembers about Gilda. But Gilda cannot be defined as a musical. And so, wait, you know, it's not just that she gets up and does the number and then it matters, but it, in context, it does not make the movie a musical. So I started looking at a lot of movies and thinking there are Westerns that have these musical numbers in them, and yet they're not musicals. And so you, what you really come to understand is there's got to be musically defined performance, music as music, performance as performance, a conscious effort to really say that if you took the music out of this, if you took the singing and dancing out of this, you don't have the same movie. It matters in a different way because it's explaining the characters, it's defining mood, it's a different approach. Even in the backstage musical, that's true.
Now, when you get further on in the book in the discussion of the Freed Unit, which we'll talk about in just a bit, you bring up a really important, three important questions that apply to the structure of musical films. And in other words, how to judge a good musical. And let's talk about them each in turn. Musical establishment. What are you talking about when you mention musical establishment?
If you sit down in your movie seat and you have no idea what you're going to see as a movie, if the movie runs 20 minutes and all of a sudden a character turns to another character and starts singing, no, wait, what? Where am I? You have to let the audience know as soon as possible, preferably in the opening, right up front with an opening number, that they are in a musical universe, that for some reason, characters sing and dance. It may only be that that's what they do for a living, but if it's, especially if it's that's what they do as they are living, then you've got to let the audience know where they are. And, you know, that's really true of all good films. They locate an audience where they should be to receive the story they're going to be told. But it's particularly important with musicals that you let the audience know people are singing and dancing in here, and that's where you are. You cannot wait too long for that. It just doesn't work if you don't.
I love your writing about the early days of musicals. And one of the ways that they establish musicals, and you mentioned this, is the classic backstage musical. And I always think about things like 42nd Street, where the film is about people trying to put on a musical. So therefore, it doesn't seem odd at all that you would see musical numbers.
Exactly. Exactly. They could be rehearsing. They could be, you know, anything that makes sense. But it does not make sense for people who are not musical performers. He works in a gas station. She works behind the counter in a department store. It does not make sense for them to be singing and dancing unless you set it up from the beginning that that is what people in this world do, you know?
In musical integration, and this is the important part, how does the music fit in with the rest of the film and the rest of the film fit in with the music?
The closer the integration, the better. I mean, one of the things is once you leave the backstage musical, the characters need to be expressing who they are, how they feel to one another through music, and it needs to be a part of the plot. When Judy Garland in Meet Me in St. Louis suddenly sings The Boy Next Door all by herself at the window in what is otherwise allegedly kind of a naturalistic setting, she's telling us something that she doesn't tell her family. She's talking to us as the viewer about how she feels about him. It's a beautiful, poignant moment, and she does it so wonderfully. It often gets overlooked because the Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas is so fabulous, that and even the trolley song, there's so many great things in that. But it needs a close integration, and Singing in the Rain is one of the great musicals, as I always say, a musical for people who hate musicals even, because everybody likes Singing in the Rain. It's funny and fun. The songs are all about something linked to the movies, Make 'em Laugh, or, you know, You Are My Lucky Star. I mean, all of these things work in the plot in a way. They're woven in. So it needs to be close. So when Fred Astaire sings Night and Day. He's wooing Ginger Rogers and overcoming her doubts, or isn't it a lovely day to walk in the rain? You know, these things need to be together, and then they seem to flow naturally. And it doesn't, we're in the flow of it as viewers, and the joy and the pleasure in the musical number is enhanced by that.
I love your writing about Singing in the Rain. And I'm going to have to ask you this. You talk about it as the perfect musical yardstick, but is it the best musical ever made for you? Well, for you. I want to hear Janine's feeling.
Yeah, no, I like Singing in the Rain a lot. And I do think it's a wonderful musical in every way. But, like, you have to go with your heart. And, like, I grew up during the, like, I was in high school and college during the 50s, like the heyday of the freed unit.
Yep.
So in my small town where I lived, American in Paris and Singing in the Rain played within 6 months of each other
at
the movie theater. I mean, that's the kind of era it was. And for me, American in Paris was the really emotional movie, and touched me very deeply and opened my eyes to a lot of things about the world outside and about, you know, emotions and ballet and paintings and everything. And I love that, and I really enjoyed Singing in the Rain. I have lots of musical favorites, you know.
Oh, I know.
Singing in the Rain would really be on my 10 favorites, I think. But, you know, it's a hard thing. I change my mind every time I'm thinking. I love Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers. I love Fred Astaire, period. So anytime I see something with him, I think, oh, this is the greatest. You know, that's how I am.
And let's talk about musical intervals.
Yeah.
And, you know, and this is something, again, until I read your book, it didn't even occur to me, but you do have a knee-jerk reaction to it. If there's too much music back-to-back in the film, audiences actually rebelled against that.
That's right. It breaks down their participation. It reminds them this is essentially a false structure that's being created. It breaks it somehow. And again, if you wait too long in between, they've forgotten that they're in a musical universe, so it jars them all over again. And, you know, I learned about that because I worked in a movie theater. And I was an usher, and I would see the same movie over and over again. And with musicals, I really came to see very clearly the audience responded that way. They were jolted and didn't like it if it had been a long time between musical numbers. And if they were back to back, they would get up and go out to the candy counter. I mean, you know, I sort of learned that by observing, and also by realizing from my own sense of the movie, watching it multiple times, how it just wasn't fluid. It was breaking down or breaking up by having the intervals incorrectly. And Hollywood, I think, these people were very shrewd filmmakers, and they understood that. They often shot a lot of numbers that they then took out and didn't use
because
it was just too much, and they knew that that wouldn't work.
I know that was true in The Wizard of Oz. They had a jitterbug number that was cut out. Okay, we have to talk. Well, let me. You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight, it is always a pleasure to talk to her, is Janine Basinger. She is the founder of the Department of Film Studies at Wesleyan University and the curator of the cinema archives there. And we're talking about her latest book, and it is just one joy after another, the movie musical. Janine, let's talk about the freed unit. There's an amazing chapter in your book, a section in your book, Gene Kelly, Stanley Donen, Vincent Minnelli, and the freed unit. What was the freed unit?
Well, at MGM, they had producing units. I mean, it's unit lowercase. I mean, there really wasn't officially anything called the Freed Unit, but producers like Arthur Freed gathered around him the people under contract at MGM that he really wanted to work with. And they worked together because they had similar goals and ideas and ambitions. And they became then a sort of working unit. And they made so many musicals together that was the label. There were two other units of making musicals also, Jack Cummings and Joe Pasternak. But the Freed Unit is that golden moment in Hollywood history where you have under contract at MGM the most unbelievable talent in every possible category, plus you also have the money and the equipment to do all of this. You've got an orchestra, you've got arrangers, composers, you know, you have this dance rehearsal people. I mean, it's an amazing, you know, coming together for like a fairly brief time in history, the ability to make these phenomenal films. They made some non-musicals also. But they really, really were great at musicals. And Arthur Freed, of course, was a songwriter. So he understood music and loved music. And he just assembled these people who had great joy in working together at a studio that supported them and gave them the money and talent they needed to do it. It's a really amazing thing.
I'm just going to skip around and talk about several different points that just tickled me when I read them. In the script to Singin' in the Rain, the key, this one sentence, Dawn dances in a wet street.
Yes, isn't that wonderful?
Oh, God. That was it.
That's it. I mean, of course it would be it. What are they going to do? They're not choreographers. They're not. I mean, don't even necessarily suggest the Singin' in the Rain song. That would have been Arthur Freed's idea, I'm sure, because he wrote the lyrics for it. But I always use that to my students to talk about what film really is and what you have to do. What the page, the script is very important, and no one would ever deny that who knows anything about movies. On the other hand, the script is a blueprint for what is going to come to life and move up on the screen in front of your eyes. And that is a great example of the reason why, as Nick Ray, the director, said, if it were all in the script, why make the movie? You know, which is just a great comment, because that's it. That this is a perfect example of that, because the Singin' in the Rain number is a beloved immortal and always will be just a fantastic number.
Summed up in one sentence.
Yes, exactly.
Vincent Minnelli, let's talk about, there's a great phrase you use in the book. He knew how to decorate sets. Why is that important?
I think that Vincent Minnelli understood that when we look into the frame and we see the picture, that everything that's in there affects our emotions and affects our response. And he knew how to set up a musical number. You can always just have a plain background and someone dancing, especially if it's Fred Astaire and you've got everything you need. But if you're making a movie that's telling a story about people in a place, in a context, characters, then the attention to detail that's linked to every single thing in the frame, Vincent Minnelli was a master at that, and he did copious research on it. He understood color, he understood shape, design, he understood period looks and research and detail. Every detail just adds to it. It's all designed to come together as one thing that enhances the pleasure you have in viewing. And then keeping it down to where the lighting focuses on what really matters, the color. I think he was a great director. I'm a big fan of Vincent Minnelli's.
Cover Girl. These are all movies I just love.
Me too.
But what was fascinating, as you write in your book, this is originally promoted as a Rita Hayworth movie with Gene Kelly.
right. And that's a Gene Kelly movie with Rita Hayworth. Well, it was a piece of very good luck for Gene Kelly that when he went to MGM, I think he was signed elsewhere and then sold over to MGM, they loaned him out to Columbia at this early stage of his career, because Columbia gave him some freedom. He took Stanley Donen over there with him, and they were allowed to create the alter ego number, that Kelly does that's so phenomenal, and to do things, you know, that maybe at MGM wouldn't have let him do, and it really made a big musical star out of him. And of course, being paired with Rita Hayworth at that point was, you know, she was a top star. He had been very lucky. He was paired with Judy Garland, of course,
that's right,
in For Me and My Gal, first at MGM. But they weren't sure. MGM thought, well, maybe he can be an actor. I mean, we have dancers. I mean, maybe we'll use him in some dramatic pieces. And they did do that in the beginning. But this success of CoverGirl really, really, really solidified his career as a musical star, as a great choreographer, as well as musical personality on film. And Rita Hayworth's stardom did a lot to bring people in to see him in that regard. And he held his own, more than held his own.
I'm going to skip ahead a little bit just because I want to mention this. Julie Andrews, a great mm-hmm. discussion. And how her career suddenly looked like it was going to take a nosedive because she lost out to Audrey Hepburn for My
right.
Fair Lady, having done it on the stage. But she got Mary Poppins.
I know.
And then The Sound of Music.
I know. It's so ironic that she ended up then winning the Oscar over Audrey Hepburn for My Fair Lady with Mary Poppins. Well, it's unthinkable to imagine that Julie Andrews could not and would not have become a big musical star because she had everything it took. And you know, when you think of her career, she stopped making musicals fairly early on. I mean, a lot of her work is dramatic and or not musical films, but she's one of the only two really great musical stars developed exclusively
right.
in the 60s, Barbara Streisand and Julie Andrews.
Right.
And when you realize that Julie Andrews originated the My Fair Lady role on Broadway and then, you know, starred in Mary Poppins and The Sound of Music, the two huge moneymakers of that decade, she is like a definitively important musical personality.
Now, The Sound of Music, and as you write in the book, this is a great movie for debate.
Yes.
And
ruining Thanksgiving dinners as people fight.
But, you know, I'm going to confess, I'm not that fond of the film. But I have friends who, it's like the Rocky Horror Picture Show, who go yeah. to see it dressed up and sing. And
yeah.
as you mentioned, it's a film about the great cultural divide that was underway at that time in America.
Absolutely. And by the way, you and I are soulmates on what we think, I believe. I agree with you. It's not my favorite either. It never would be or
and
could
be. And you reprint some great, terrible reviews of it.
Yes, I did. I have to admit I did. I think Julie Andrews is wonderful, but I'm just not a fan. And the director is a very good director, all of that, but I'm just like, okay, it fine, there it is. It's got big mountains. I just don't, you know what I mean? It does.
Hey, climb that mountain.
Yes, exactly. Well, I have to. I certainly have over and over. But you know, it doesn't get to me in that in some way. It's just I don't. What can I tell you?
Well, we only have minutes left, and I want to talk about that. It doesn't get you because you said some very interesting things about the problem with La La Land, and it wasn't until I read them that I understood what my problem was with it, because I watched the movie and it was all this and that, but for some reason there was no moment when I went, whoa, this is a movie I'm going to watch again.
Yeah. Well, I did not like La La Land. I mean, first of all, I was willing to like it. I wanted to like it.
Me
too. I've been told.
Me too.
Yeah, we wanted it. We want.
Well, everybody else was raving about it.
Well, yes, and I'm told this loony comments like this revolutionizes the musical. No, it doesn't. But the point is, I wait a minute, people. Are you noticing that this movie has two people who really don't sing and dance well? What is up with that? I mean, if I'm going to watch a musical, give me musical talent.
That's right.
That is all I have to say.
You're right about there's a moment with the poster of Ingrid Bergman in
yes.
it, where you realize the poster's really touching your heart, but the film isn't.
That's right. You look at that and you see the issue. Ingrid Bergman's face on a poster is more alive, illuminated, beautiful, and enveloping than what is happening on screen with the people acting. And the Casablanca, I think it's a Casablanca
right.
poster, it makes you suddenly think of Casablanca, and you wish you were watching that. I mean, it's just shows about stardom.
I also felt it was sort of arch. It was like an intellectual exercise where they were
yes.
trying to cite different references to musicals.
Yeah,
and it was like a collection of those.
I agree. It's too intellectualized. I mean, it's about appreciating the musical instead of being a musical. It's distanced from itself in that regard, and it's more of an academic exercise, although I think they tried to not make it, but it was. It doesn't have the high. Look, think of any of the great musicals you love. Think of the great musical stars who you can watch their work over and over and over again and feel what you're supposed to feel from the number. And that is what musicals are. They're supposed to be about that. And this movie does not have that quality.
Top Hat does that for me all the time, and we're completely out of time. We're completely
oh,
out of time. No, and we could talk.
Where we started.
Well, we can talk again. We'll talk again. My returning guest tonight is Janine Basinger. She is the founder of the Department of Film Studies at Wesleyan University, the curator of the cinema archives there. And we're talking about her latest book, which has so much room for discussion. It's ridiculous. The Movie Musical. Janine, it's a real pleasure.
Thank you, Mark. It's always wonderful to talk to you, and I hope you will have me back again
soon. Of course I will.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.
Come on along and listen to the lullaby of Broadway, the hip parade and ballyhoo, the lullaby of Broadway. The rumble of the subway train, the rattle of the taxis, the daffodils who entertain at Angelo's and Maxine's when the Broadway baby.